I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hi, and welcome to Radio Motherboard. This is Jason Kebler, and today we're talking about Facebook. I've got Emmanuel Myberg.
Hello.
And out of Motherboard's European apparatus, we have Joseph Cox.
Hey.
Thank you guys both for joining us. We're going to cover probably a lot of ground today. I also have an interview with Yuan Stevens, who's a human rights lawyer in Canada, to talk a little bit about regulating Facebook. Facebook has been all over the news yet, these past couple of months. Emmanuel, have you seen any of these ads that have been on the subway? You don't ride the subway, do you?
No, I don't. I don't go down there, but I have seen them online. I have seen like the video ad for Facebook coming back as a platform for your friends and family, and not for politics and Russian operatives and things like that.
Yeah. So here on the New York subway, they have Facebook has bought a ton of ads that say clickbait is not your friend. False news and fake news is bad and things of that nature. And I saw them online first, but I rode the subway quite a lot this weekend, and they're everywhere. They're in like every station. I have not really seen a media blitz like this from Facebook. And I think it's obviously relating to sort of the Cambridge Analytica stuff, but also this idea that, Facebook played some role in highlighting fake news during the election and that sort of thing. And we also saw this documentary, I guess you could call it a documentary, as sort of like propaganda from Facebook that was released last week. Emmanuel, can you talk a little bit about that piece of work?
Yeah, I mean, it's all part of the same theme. It seems like following the election, or even more recently following the Cambridge Analytica story, Facebook PR and marketing had a sit down, and they were, and this is me just speculating based on the content of this campaign, but just like, how do we rehabilitate our image? What do we want Facebook to be thought of in the public? And everything flows from that. So one aspect of it is the ads that you're talking about on the subway, which are trying to shift Facebook from this platform where you get your news, which, as it turns out, a lot of which is bad and harmful to the country, and go from that to like, oh, this is where you go to talk to your family and see pictures of your friends' kids and stuff like that. And then the other aspect of it is, well, people are going to share news and people are going to share information on the platform. And now we are very serious about it, and we are very aware of the impact that we're having, which is something that Zuckerberg has said as well, right? He sort of acknowledged that he didn't realize what a difference Facebook made in the world, and now they're coming out with this new face, which is like a responsible Facebook, and we have all these experts here now to help us, not push fake news stories or propaganda.
Yeah, so I'm going to play a clip from that video.
Fundamentally, Facebook is about trying to bring people together. We're trying to figure out what stories people are going to find interesting. We look at, do you like a story? Do you comment on a story? Do you share a story?
Nearly everything you see in your newsfeed, you're seeing because somebody who you're connected with or a page that you've decided to follow decided to share that. For a time, we felt our responsibility was mostly around just trying to help organize that information that you, in some sense, had asked to see. There was some reluctance to try to get in between you and those people.
Yeah, so this is all of a piece, and it seems like a lot of the sort of cleaning up of Facebook, or what they seem to be doing, is related to its algorithm and how it's going to show pages in the newsfeed. Facebook has also announced that it's going to let you see who is the administrator of some of these pages and where they're located, which has some of its own problems. But I think another part of all of this is Facebook has a very difficult job here. It has a very difficult job to do in terms of surfacing things that that you know are, I guess, helpful to society that people also want to see. But it also has a very difficult job in terms of making sure that people don't abuse the platform and making sure that people don't you know, use it for hate or use it for violence, use it for you know, sexual revenge and things like that. And that's sort of where some of Joseph's reporting comes in. Joseph, can you talk a little bit about some of the stories you've published in the last few weeks?
Yeah, sure. So we got training materials that are used by Facebook's and in some cases Instagram's moderators. So that's stuff like a PowerPoint presentation saying what you should and should not ban, the sort of Nazi or hate groups that are not allowed on Facebook, and also training videos where a trainer is going over and explaining to these potential mods, or maybe they're already moderators and they're getting sort of a tune-up, just reminding them of the site's policies and what they need to be on the lookout for. Yeah.
So in the past few weeks, we've run stories about Facebook's revenge porn policies, which, you know, they very recently took this sort of enlightened position that people who are posting about receiving unsolicited dick pics in their inbox should not be banned from the platform, which is, it should be a no-brainer. But once you sort of like drill down into how it works specifically, it is tough for someone who is viewing something like this sort of out of context entirely. Do you remember what the shift was there, Joseph?
Yeah, so originally, when someone would receive a dick pic, and maybe that was on Facebook or Twitter, it didn't have to specifically be on Facebook, but then the person would take that dick pic and post it onto Facebook and say, oh my God, this is disgusting, somebody sent me this dick pic. Previously, Facebook moderators would, rather ironically, have flagged that as revenge porn because the victim is posting, you know, a non-consensual nude image, even if this pervert had sent them a dick pic. And clearly, Facebook noticed that. There were a few media reports about women complaining about dick pics and then getting banned or having the content removed or whatever it may be. Now it's been switched, so only the image is removed under the nudity policy and not the revenge porn policy. And they're not banned either. Again, the context really depends. The person posting the dick pic, as in the victim, has to, according to the training material, explicitly condemn the dick pic. So they can't just post it without context, because then the moderator is not going to know what to do. It just shows how, as you say, when you really drill down to it, it gets really complicated. And moderators have to somehow navigate all of these new ways of abuse, of hate, or whatever it may be, and are constantly trying to shift that balance. And just not ban people who are legitimately complaining about issues.
Yeah, I mean, it does feel like splitting hairs here, and it's sort of, not to editorialize too much, but it's pretty shocking to see sort of the specifics of this. Like, you know, dick pics are not okay on our platform under any circumstances, which I think is probably a fine policy to have. Like, these should probably just be deleted because, you know, people don't generally want to see that on their feed. But if there's no condemnation, then, you know, then it's revenge porn. If there is condemnation, then it's simply, you know, someone complaining about something that happened to them, most likely on that platform or possibly on that platform. So in general, you know, you'd want Facebook to stop that from happening, but it seems like it's not really that easy to do. It's not easy to stop someone from sending an unsolicited dick pic if they're already friends or already have like the means for messaging them, because you know, there are probably a lot of people sharing solicited dick pics and nudes and sexting and stuff on Messenger and Instagram. So then you get into questions of whether you want Facebook to like run image recognition software on DMs and things like that. So It is tough. It also, I don't have a whole lot of sympathy for them because this is, you know, one of the richest companies in the world. They have generally had some very high profile mess ups. And in general, Facebook has employed a lot of low wage contractors, has done a lot of experimentation with like image recognition and stuff like that that aren't quite there yet. And if you listen to Mark Zuckerberg speak at the congressional hearings last month, you know, there was a lot of, you know, we can't get content moderation right at the moment, but we're trying to get algorithms to do it for us. Emmanuel, do you think that is the path forward, or do you think Facebook's doing a good job here? What do you think of all of this?
In terms of the, like, the dick pic and revenge porn stuff specifically?
I think just content moderation. I mean, the dick pic thing is sort of a lens through which we can see this debate. And there's a lot more that we'll talk about as well, but just to sort of open things up here.
Yeah, I think we are very critical of Facebook often on Motherboard, and for good reason. But to be fair, I think that, as you said, the question of moderation is very difficult. And especially if you're coming at it from what seems to be Mark Zuckerberg's perspective, where they try to be neutral, which, I mean, I personally think is impossible. But if that's what they're striving for, how you draw this line between, you know, an image that is revenge porn and somebody complaining about getting an unsolicited dick pic, it's like, that's very complicated. And even more complicated, which is what I want to talk about, is this one of the things that Joseph reported is how Facebook dealt with the issue of American Nazis on Facebook after the Charlottesville Unite the Right protest, where a protester was hit with a car and killed. And yeah, so in that particular case, they're trying to draw a line around what is the difference between a white supremacist and a white nationalist, and why one is okay on Facebook and the other is not. But I guess Joseph, can you talk about that specific aspect of Facebook's like instruction material for moderators?
Yeah, sure. So as you say, post Charlottesville, there was a training document made for the moderators, which basically said that after Charlottesville, there's a lot of potential confusion about what sort of groups we ban or what individuals we ban, and that sort of thing. So it was kind of a refresher for the moderators, but it also appears there were some new policies put in as well. And as you say, they kind of make this distinction between a white supremacist, a white separatist, and a white nationalist, with the latter two, the nationalism and the separatism, apparently being okay. On Facebook, you can praise, support, or represent actually being one of those people. On the platform and supremacy, you can't. The issue, obviously, there is that some of these groups may use one of those terms as a front for when they actually mean supremacy. And perhaps their real ultimate goal is white supremacy, but they just say they're nationalists. And then in the documents themselves, Facebook even acknowledges that sometimes a group may define themselves inconsistently. So it's actually going to be hard to enforce the policy and this distinction anyway, which of course just brings up the idea of, well, presumably it's going to be even harder for the moderators to actually get legitimate cases of hate speech off the platform, or not legitimate, but genuine cases of hate speech off the platform, if it's this sort of arbitrary distinction, which is then very, very blurry. So it just goes to show whether are these policies actually going to be effective if that is how Facebook is defining these sorts of groups.
Yeah.
Right. So that's one. Sorry.
No, I mean, I just want to put this a bit in context here. When we're talking about things like revenge porn or some of these sort of newer issues that have arisen specifically because of social media and because, you know, all of our devices have cameras on them and we can send photos instantly. These are things that Facebook and other social media companies, these are like social media native problems where, you know, they're sort of trying to figure out a policy that works to a problem that was created because of social media on some level. Whereas when we're talking about white supremacy and you know, racial hate, especially in the United States, it's so baked into the history of this country. There's a lot of context that seems to be missing here from Facebook's policies. And you know, granted, we have, you know, a training document. We don't know exactly how these policies were made. However, it seems like, and you know, I don't know, and we're doing more reporting around this, and we need to do more reporting around this. It seems like this was a policy made to protect white people. And we've seen in the past that Facebook considers white men to be a protected class. There was some ProPublica reporting in 2017 that showed this. And if you talk to a lot of scholars, and we certainly need to talk to more people, and I would like to preface this by saying, you know, these are three white dudes talking on a podcast. We're doing this because it's sort of stuff that we're breaking right now, and we need to get more and different voices on this podcast to talk about this specific issue. But the line between white supremacy and white nationalism and white separatism is not a line at all, I think, is what a lot of people would say. When you look at the history of racist violence in the United States, a lot of white supremacy was couched in sort of rhetoric that, you know, separate but equal, you know, nationalism as opposed to hate. And once you see how that rhetoric was used throughout the history of America and in other countries as well, this policy seems a lot worse, I think, a lot more insidious, and it seems like it's something that was made without the input of people of color, or possibly without the input of historians and people who have studied this issue in America.
Yeah, I think that at the moment, the level of nuance in these moderation guidelines is zero. I mean, it's sort of, if your group is, you know, we are, you know, the American Nazis of New York, and, you know, we feel that this minority is inferior to white people, then that is not allowed. But if it's just like half a step removed, right, which is what we're talking about when we're talking about white nationalism, we're talking about separatism, then that is okay. Now, I think, Jason, you and I are coming at it from a historical perspective where there is an implied violence in separation, and there is, you know, we've seen the outcome of trying to separate ethnic groups throughout history. You know, whether you're looking at Nazi Germany, which at first was like, hey, we just want these communities away from us, right? And that involved violence. And then you look at, I don't know, apartheid, or you look at the way Israel is separating Jews and Palestinians. And even in this own country, if you're looking at this whole separate but equal doctrine, right? So it's like, it's pretending to be about, hey, we just want each group in their own corner, but in order to achieve that, you're always going to, you know, inflict a great amount of pain on these groups. And Facebook, in this particular instance right now, is not acknowledging that. But I think, and again, if I was Mark Zuckerberg and I was running the company, like, this would be an easy decision for me to make, to put, you know, white nationalists and white separatists in the same group. But let's say they go down this path of, you know, trying to have more nuance in these guidelines, then it's like, where do they draw the line, right? Like, because there's a lot of political positions that, you know, are like 4 steps removed from racism, or 5 steps removed from racism. You know what I mean? So it's like it does get complicated.
Yeah, to be clear, I'm just going to read the slide because we haven't said specifically what it is. So the slide is called Hate Speech Highlights. Question, what is our stance on white supremacy, white nationalism, and white separatism? And then there's a bullet point. It says, we don't allow praise, support, and representation of white supremacy as an ideology. Example, quote, white supremacy is the right thing, end quote. Quote, I'm a white supremacist. Quote, join the next white supremacy rally. Quote. Next bullet point. We allow praise, support, and representation of white nationalism as an ideology. Example, white nationalism is the only way, or I'm a proud white nationalist. And then third bullet point is we allow praise, support, and representation of white separatism as an ideology. Example, white separatism is the perfect solution to America's problems. I am a white separatist. And then it says, by the same token, we allow to call for the creation of white ethno states. Example, the U.S. should be a white only nation. So this is pretty explicit stuff. I mean, I don't know if you'd call it nuance, but there are distinctions made. And these examples are quite, they're clear. Obviously, you know, there are probably many shades of gray or whatever you want to say in between what someone might actually post and the imagery that they'll put and the rest of their profile and stuff like that. But these are pretty like distinct things that they're saying that it does feel like splitting hairs. However, Facebook is putting its flag in the ground and saying, we allow for the call of a white ethno state. Or we allow people to say, I am a proud white nationalist. And I think just judging from Twitter this weekend when, you know, I tweeted out Joseph's story and a image of this slide, and there are a lot of people saying that there is no distinction between these things when you take it in a historical context, and when you look at how these things have been used to marginalize people of color as well as, you know, commit violence against them.
Yeah, I mean, I would just say, looking back at the slide now, that second bullet point where it says it allows white nationalism, and the second example is, I am a proud white nationalist. Elsewhere in the training documents, it says you cannot declare yourself as a racist, as in you cannot say, I am a proud racist. But you can say, I'm a proud white nationalist, which, looking back at the slides, is, I mean, there's even less of a degree of separation there. Like, they're saying you can't say this. You cannot declare yourself part of this group. You can declare yourself part of this group when, come on, really? Like, with the context, it's pretty clear.
Yeah, it also makes me wonder, our friends at Vice News wrote a story about Richard Spencer's Facebook page, I think it was. It was for his publication, I believe, correct me if I'm wrong, but it was like altright.com or something like that. And following the report, Facebook banned the page. And, I mean, if they allow white nationalists on the platform, then why was he kicked off? Because that is basically his position, right? When you hear him speak, when you hear him talk about his philosophy, he is a separatist. And he is also a supremacist if you dig an inch deep, right? But I think once you start getting into the policing of this, it becomes pretty inconsistent.
Yeah, and I think that we can use this as a bit of a jumping off point to talk about content moderation across platforms. We definitely want to go back to Facebook, but what we've seen is that Facebook, Google, Twitter, they are learning what is allowed and not allowed on their platform as they go. They're sort of making up the rules as they go. Twitter has changed its rules like 500 times. There's a really good story that Sarah Zhang wrote for us a couple years ago about, you know, the changing of Facebook's or the changing of Twitter's rules rather. And something that we have found in our reporting, especially Joseph's reporting of late, is that a lot of this stuff isn't banned from any of these social media sites until a journalist points it out to them. And it's unclear whether that's because these sites are not good at finding content that violates their own rules or because they don't want the bad publicity that goes along with, hey, there are Nazis on Facebook, or, you know, here's Adam Waffen Division, which is an American neo-Nazi group, with, you know, propaganda videos on YouTube or and things like that. So, Joseph, can you talk a little bit about your experiences just reporting on some of these things and how things that are allowed one day are suddenly not allowed the second you ask about them?
Yeah, that's basically the dynamic that we've had here, especially with Nazi stuff. And even when I worked at the Daily Beast and we were doing a lot of reporting on Russian misinformation on Reddit, Twitter, Facebook, and a bit of Tumblr as well. Basically, what will happen is a journalist will find something, they'll do their reporting, they'll then go to the company for comment, for sake of argument, let's just say it's Facebook. They will then say, oh, okay, yeah, please provide the examples. You do that, the offending material magically disappears, and then they say, oh, no, actually, we're not going to give you a comment. So basically, the journalist is being used as a de facto content moderator, which is not the job of a journalist. It's to point out the inconsistencies or the failings of the social platform's moderation policies, but not actually work as a outside contractor for Facebook. So that dynamic happens across the platforms repeatedly. And I think it even got to the point where with the neo-Nazis on YouTube, when they were just going through a particular wave of hate speech after ProPublica released an investigation into that group you mentioned, Atom Waffen Division. And you just type in the bare names of a load of hate groups on YouTube and they come up really, really easily. So go to YouTube to comment and they ask, provide us the examples. And if I recall correctly, I actually declined to do so because, again, that's not our job. We're providing you enough context to give a statement, which is that, hey, if you go search for these groups on your platform, you will find them. So we didn't give the examples in the end. And I think that's probably quite a healthy thing to do, obviously, depending on the story, because otherwise our jobs and our roles are just going to blur into something else. But yeah, that dynamic is pretty established, not just with us, but with other publications as well. And it doesn't really show any sign of slowing down either.
Yeah, there was a time period when we were covering deepfakes, which is computer-generated AI porn that was being used to do face swaps of celebrities and eventually of sort of normal people onto porn videos, where we were like going from platform to platform and finding these no problem, and then saying, "Hey, do you have any comment on this?" And they'd say no, and they'd take it down. And it was like it got to be, and we'll have Samantha Cole, who did this reporting, we'll have her on an episode soon. But it got to be a point where it felt like we were playing whack-a-mole. Like it was like, hey, here's some porn, take it down. Hey, here's some porn, take it down. And I think that can be pretty demoralizing from a sort of journalistic perspective, because you want to go to companies for comment because that's sort of how journalism works, and you want to you want to talk to them and see if they're going to take a stance against this. But I think sort of PR 101 is just like, say nothing interesting ever, get the thing off the platform and hope it goes away. And that's sort of what was happening for months, where we were just like getting a bunch of no comments and just the things would get taken down and we'd move on with our lives and be whack-a-mole.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
I want to add to this question of moderation and reporting on moderation is that, like you two said, it can be demoralizing, but I don't think we've really found a solution to this as a publication. And I hope, Jason, this is okay, but like we're giving a little peek here behind the curtain of how we think about things editorially. But it's like, it is it is a challenge because I think the outcome of these stories where we come to a platform, we say, hey, here's a thing that violates your policy for good reason because it's bad, and then they take it down, and then we do it again. It's like, we could do this right now. We could all sit at our computers. We can think about something that violates YouTube's policy, Pornhub's policy, Facebook's policy, do a quick search, find the offending material, reach out to the platform, get it removed. And getting it removed, I think we would agree, is bad, right? If there is like an Adam Woffen division Facebook group and they are organizing on Facebook, that will have real world outcomes that are bad. And if our reporting puts a stop to it, I think that's a good thing. So in a sense, those stories are tiresome, but what happens when we completely give up on this role that has been arbitrarily given to us of like being platform content moderators, you know, it's an ongoing, it's an open question, you know, I don't know how we handle this position that we found ourselves in yet.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's a relatively new position that we as a publication have found ourselves in, I think. You know, we've been doing reporting on social media companies for a long time, but I would say with the rise of sort of online harassment, Gamergate, things like that, and now the alt-right and Nazis and things like that, very insidious, and things that I feel comfortable as a publication taking a stand against. And that, you know, these companies like Facebook and YouTube have said, this is not okay on our platform. At least versions of this are not okay on our platform. So I think it's fair to point those out and then ask, you know, what are you going to do about this? So I don't think it's not demoralizing in some sense, because these platforms do take it down. And like we saw with deepfakes, you know, this was a thing on Reddit that had grown to have hundreds of thousands of people sharing it. And because of our reporting, you know, it's no longer on any major platform, or at least it's not supposed to be. And if you go looking for it on Reddit, you probably won't be able to find much, or you may be able to find like some small communities. And there, I guess there's still some on Pornhub, but they have also taken a stance against it. So, you know, that stuff is now being traded on like small forums and stuff like that. So we sort of identified a problem, reported on it, and it went away, which was that felt good for that to happen.
Yeah, I think the difference there is there are instances in which you are reporting on content that is against policy and you're pointing it out to the platform and they take it down. And then in the case of deepfakes and Reddit, our reporting actually led to a policy change, right? So that is the difference. Like, there wasn't a policy against them, and then following our reporting, they implemented a new policy, and I think that is why, in that case, it feels rewarding. Whereas if I hit up Pornhub every 3 weeks about like a new crop of deepfakes videos on their platform, and then they take it down, that gets into that whack-a-mole scenario, which I think is kind of exhausting. I have a question to go back to the white supremacy, white nationalist question on Facebook. What do you think is like the real world impact of this policy? Is it something that you think we've seen? Is it something that just is like a bad? Is this just a bad slide, or is it something that has real world impact?
I guess, yeah, I'll take that. This is all speculation, and it's just based on, you know, talking to people about their experiences. It's demoralizing to see that in such stark terminology on the website, I think. There is a sense that, you know, people of color are not protected online, and they are harassed more often than white men are. They are silenced more often than white people are. And specifically, if you're talking about the way that women are treated online, I think, you know, a lot of people of color are treated online in similar ways, where if they speak out about something, they are then harassed about it and are silenced. So there's a lot of discussion about free speech online, and you know, should there be free speech on Reddit or Facebook or what have you? And there is not free speech online because, in part, these are private companies. But a bigger issue here is that they protect majority opinions, and they protect sort of majority voices. So they protect the voices that have always been protected, that have been protected by society as a whole, because they have power. So, you know, I think to facilitate free speech and to facilitate hearing some voices that have not been heard, you'd like to see a policy that more strictly doesn't allow this sort of thing. And I think it probably has had real world implications, and it's hard to say, because it's hard to say how much anything that happens on social media impacts the sort of, I guess, hearts and minds of people. But if you look back, you know, you can't really say how much impact the Russian disinformation campaigns had on the election, but the impact was likely greater than zero. It was greater than no impact at all. So, you know, if you have people in your timeline who are sharing white separatist and white nationalist beliefs, and Facebook is allowing that, you know, maybe it's radicalized some people. Maybe some of these groups have grown very large. It's hard to say without sort of looking at specifically the, you know, the types of content that's been allowed, and how it affects people. And that's something that, you know, even scientists and people who've researched this have had a lot of trouble discerning, is sort of the like impact on public opinion and that sort of thing of social media.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the danger is that in the same sort of way that you may have misogynistic or really sexist material spreading online rapidly, in the same sort of way you may have nationalism and separatism, if that's allowed to stay, the danger is that it could normalize the sort of content that leads to more extreme behavior, or normalize the sort of content that essentially acts as a front for the more violent, extreme material. As you say, obviously it's very hard to quantify that, but there is a danger there. Yeah, I think it would be fair to say that.
Yeah, and another piece that you reported that you can talk about briefly is Facebook's stance on Pepe the Frog, which was, you know, obviously a meme that became really popular a couple years ago, and then was turned into like this alt-right meme for a while. I'm not sure where Pepe sort of stands right now in the current like online discourse. I haven't really seen many Pepes around for a while, but you know, during the 2016 campaign, it was used by a lot of Donald Trump supporters, and then it was also used in sort of a racist and anti-Semitic context for quite a while. So Facebook banned Pepe the Frog in sort of like racist contexts. Is that right, Joseph?
Yeah, so usually Facebook allows fictional characters or settings in the context of hate. So one example they give in the slide is a sort of X-ray image of Homer Simpson with a swastika like sort of embedded into his skull. And that would be allowed because it's a fictional character. And I suppose you can think of other examples, maybe like Wolfenstein 2 or something, which will have depictions of hate because obviously you're killing a load of Nazis, but that's still going to be allowed. They don't explicitly give that example, but that's just one that I imagine would also be allowed as well. And then straight after, in another slide, they say, well, there is an exception, and it's the Pepe one. Usually, if it's just a normal Pepe image, you know, him staring at his hands or whatever it may be, like the original meme, it's okay. But then, as you say, obviously it's been adopted within this alt-right hateful context, and you have Pepe's outside a concentration camp or wearing an SS uniform. Now, even though that's a fictional character, Facebook has made the explicit internal decision to ban those. We don't exactly know why they've decided to take that leap. I guess it's just because Pepe was such a, for lack of a better word, phenomenon, like throughout the 2016 election and when it became linked with this hateful context. I don't know if they've done it with any other sort of fictional characters as well, but it appears not, at least at the moment. But it was certainly unusual that they made they didn't do a policy change. They just made a single exception to their policy, which seems pretty noteworthy.
Right. And a lot of the slides that you have viewed say that Facebook and Instagram in particular have changed policies because of PR fires. So that does speak a little bit to the idea that, you know, they are on some level responding to journalist inquiries and responding to public opinion on this sort of thing.
Yeah, that's true. So Instagram has to deal with everything a social media platform is going to deal with, you know, bestiality, terrorism, organized crime, that sort of thing. I mean, we found Instagram accounts selling encrypted BlackBerry phones, which usually end up in the hands of like an organized gang or one company was selling to the Sinaloa drug cartel, allegedly. So Instagram has to deal with all that as well. And yeah, that internal slide saying, well, they don't say explicitly that they are responding because of the journalist inquiries, but it is highly implied because, as you say, they say that these sorts of issues create, quote unquote, PR fires. So, yeah, they are clearly responding in some sort of way to either public perception or the journalist reporting. And I suppose that goes to the point of journalists acting as content moderators as well.
Yeah. Emmanuel, do you have anything else you want to touch on?
Yeah, I guess just something that I keep coming back to is I think a lot of the problems here are this question of whether we think about Facebook as a media company and as a publisher, and if whether Facebook thinks of itself as a media company and a publisher. Just as a thought experiment, if you imagine the New York Times or Motherboard publishing a piece that argues that white supremacy is bad but white nationalism is okay, I think that we would be criticized very hard for that. And for some reason, when it's Facebook, the equation is not the same. It doesn't seem like they get the same penalty, even though they probably should. And I think internally for them, I mean, if they would go through the same thought process that we go through, they could avoid a lot of these issues, you know. Like if somebody pitched us an editorial about the merits of phrenology or eugenics or something like that, we would just dismiss it, you know, without much discussion, because for us that discussion is over, that debate is settled. And in the same way that like this white separatist question is for us is settled, it's not, it doesn't have any merit. It's a very thinly veiled racist position. And I think that if Facebook sort of had the same discussions about what content they allow on the platform, we wouldn't see slides like this.
Yeah, I think that's right. I think also Facebook has, you know, this is speculation as well, but I think Facebook has made the political calculus that it, you know, it's this company that has essentially, you know, the infiltrated every American household in the United States, or some gigantic percentage of people have Facebooks, which means people across all sorts of political leanings. And so what you saw, like a big existential threat to Facebook, or maybe not existential, but a big threat to Facebook a few years ago, was when there was a news cycle that Facebook was sort of censoring conservatives on its trending news feed. And, you know, there, I think there's some problems with that reporting, and whether it was totally on base or not is sort of up for debate. There's a good Wired art cover story about this. But if you followed the news after that, you know, Facebook like bent over backwards to show that it was, you know, fair to conservatives and America's political right. And I think that this is probably what happened here, where Facebook doesn't want to be seen as censoring content that is, you know, more conservative. And I don't think that white supremacy and white nationalism and white separatism are conservative viewpoints or should be accepted in on that side of the political spectrum. I don't think it is an acceptable political position to hold. However, I think that there are probably shades of something that someone could say where they that would get deleted, where, you know, someone, Alex Jones or you know, Bill O'Reilly or something says, oh my God, Facebook is silencing conservatives, like this is code red. And I bet that that is how this policy got passed. It's basically like, we need to look like we're fair. And so here's what's allowed and here's what's not. Here's where we're going to draw the line. And it's a line that we're going to draw because we want to look as though we are unbiased. And in doing so, they're showing that they are they have ignored a lot of the sort of context of history, I think.
Yeah. I would say just one more last thing is that it definitely feels like the current moderation guidelines were not written by people who have studied history. It doesn't feel like it was written by, it doesn't feel like a lot of people of color were involved in the process. And it just feels like it was written by Facebook engineers, to me personally. I can't support that, but it's hard for me to imagine a history professor in the room and saying like, yeah, this is cool. This is a good policy.
Yeah, and this all goes back to the fact that there's not a lot of transparency here about how anything works. And, you know, Facebook probably has its own reasons for not releasing all of its moderation guidelines. However, I think that if it had made this more of a public process, if it had invited a bunch of different people from, you know, broad variety of backgrounds and expertise, knowledge areas, I think that we would have a Facebook moderation system that is more equitable and one that makes more sense. However, you know, all of this is looked at as either proprietary or something that, you know, could look bad for Facebook. And so what you end up with is you have these slides that get leaked because these, you know, positions are not perfect and we have no idea how they were made because Facebook won't talk about the process. And I think that they need to. I think that if they were more open about this, we would have a better and safer and honestly, you know, a healthier social media ecosystem probably.
Yeah, and if Mark Zuckerberg keeps talking about it as a community, then this community should be involved in the process of how it polices itself.
Yeah, I think that's right. I'm going to end this, I think, unless you guys have any final thoughts, we'll segue into an interview I had with UN Stevens a few weeks ago, who is a human rights lawyer in Canada. She had some really interesting thoughts about how to regulate Facebook, how data should be protected, you know, whether government takeover of Facebook makes any sense, which is a thought experiment we did on Motherboard about a month ago. This interview is a little bit, it's not outdated because it's still very, very relevant. And we talked a lot about GDPR, which is a set of European data regulations that just went into effect at the end of last week. But I was unable to get this edited and up for a little while, so I'm happy it's running now. Do you guys have anything else to say before we hop into that interview?
I guess just going back a bit, I'll add in that, yeah, it does read like these white supremacy policies weren't necessarily written by people who understand the context. But the funny thing is that Facebook does work with academics and organizations such as the Anti-Defamation League on certain parts of its policies, saying that after we published the white supremacy slide, someone from the ADL was complaining that, oh, well, you're making this separation when we would actually say nationalism, separatism, and supremacy are basically all the same thing. So even if Facebook is apparently working with these groups and academics, well, apparently they're not talking to each other very closely because one side completely disagrees with the other, at least in that very specific example.
Yeah, or they're not privy to everything. You know, they're only talking to them through a very specific lens on a very specific set of issues.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. Well, thank you, Joseph and Emmanuel. Here's my interview with Yuan Stevens, and we will be back on Thursday. Okay, So I'm here with Yuann Stevens, who is a human rights lawyer and cyber feminist researcher at McGill University. She's also worked at the Berkman Center at Harvard University. Yuann, thanks so much for being here.
Such a pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so one thing that we've been talking about on staff is, what if, this is just a thought experiment, I don't think it's very realistic, but I think it's worth sort of thinking through, is like, what if the United States government said tomorrow, okay, we are going to take over Facebook, we're going to buy Facebook, we're going to nationalize it, we're going to continue to try to operate it because we think it's important, we think social media is important, but we want to do so, you know, benevolently, and we want to, that idea obviously would scare a lot of people. And I think, you know, some people would say, okay, great, socialist takeover of Facebook might be needed. But then you look at sort of the size of Facebook, and, you know, I would assume the U.S. government would take it over because the U.S. based company, but clearly Facebook is a global entity. And so there's no real answer here, but it's like, even with more regulation, it would be, you know, maybe regulation from the U.S. government. But what does that mean for people in, Canada? What does it mean for people in Germany? What does it mean for people all over the developing world? And you start looking at this behemoth, and it almost seems ungovernable. I don't know if that is too dire of an outlook, but I mean, do you think that? I know we're raising questions, and there's not a lot of answers here, but do you think Facebook can be governed in a way that is equitable for
everyone? You offer two extremes in a way, that we either see a state or government take over of Facebook, this behemoth, or we sort of see it as completely a sort of regulatory wasteland, this sort of inevitable Wild West, which of course we know is the sort of metaphor with which we've understood the internet in the past. I actually think that there is a middle ground, and I can see that we are probably going to need to move towards what we see in Europe in terms of the general data protection regulation. I'm not saying that we should adopt in the US or in Canada all elements of this law, but this stance on the part of a state or numerous states of imposing, like, as I said, positive obligations, that is, things that you should do versus things that you merely should not do on companies, I think is going to be increasingly necessary, particularly because companies like Facebook are actually offering essential services and are offering things that constitute public spheres, such as these social media websites. So that's actually a middle ground to your answer. I think that it also relates to how we see, again, the purpose of a corporation. If we see that a corporation is offering quasi-state-like services, then I think that the more that they offer those, the more they should be treated as a government while not necessarily being regulated or taken over by the government, which I can see is a sort of a dystopic image for me. And with that in mind, I think that we as North Americans can probably see a lot of benefit in certain aspects of that European General Data Protection Regulation law, which does restrict how personal data is collected and handled, and actually requires companies to be very clear and concise and transparent about what data is collected and how it is used, and particularly if the data is supposed to be is going to be used to create profiles of our actions. And it gives consumers like ourselves the right to access that data and carefully circumscribed things that we can do and requests that we can make with respect to that data. So I think that, to answer your question, I don't want the states, I don't want, you know, countries and governments to control social media in terms of actually running them. I see a lot of problems with that. I also don't think that social media companies like Facebook are completely unregulatable, that we cannot regulate them. Because I see one example, just to, you know, bolster that last claim, is the idea that, of course, you know, this general data protection regulation in Europe has indeed affected Facebook's policies, you know, Google's policies and what they allow based on your IP address or other ways that they can confirm that you're in Europe, in certain countries of Europe. And we also see that in Canada, we actually are a regulatory body with respect to privacy rights, the privacy commissioner on the federal level. actually simply publicly questioned Facebook's use of their tool that uses image recognition technology to propose that you be tagged in a photo. So because of the qualms that our privacy commissioner had with this tool that you would think is ubiquitous, of course Facebook would just offer all people the choice or the enforced sort of suggested tagging of a photo. In fact, Facebook stopped that service or that tool from being offered in Canada because of this question that was raised by our privacy commissioner. It wasn't even something that was turned into law, as far as I understand. So we see that in Europe, in Canada, companies are responsive to things that and to restrictions and to requirements that actually protect us.
Right. You mentioned, you mentioned that Facebook is creating profiles of us. Cambridge Analytica created profiles of us. I think the thing that scares me the most and probably scares a lot of other people the most is that in many ways, these algorithms, like our Facebook profile and our responses to personality quiz and the history of our online, output may paint a different picture of us than we think of ourselves. Like, I feel like my Facebook probably knows who I am better than I know who I am if I were to say, oh yeah, like I am these things. And in many ways, it's a very much a black box. We don't really know what profiles or what boxes Cambridge Analytica put us into. In many ways, I think that just knowing would go a long way to knowing it and being able to get rid of that information if we don't want it out there would go a long way, I think.
I tend to agree that knowing it is key. Knowing what data companies like Facebook or Google have on us, knowing how they use it, and of course the question of whether or not we have a right to be forgotten or whether or not we have a right to edit or correct information they have on us is a whole other Pandora's box, and a contentious issue for understandable reasons. But I think that moving towards the requirement on companies of disclosing to us what they have and how they use it is an important and critical first step.
You also raised the point of Facebook and other companies offering sort of critical basic services and sort of stand in for the government in certain ways and public spheres and squares. I'm wondering, there's been a move, this week to delete Facebook. I don't really know how much, like, it's easy to say hashtag delete Facebook. I don't know how many people are actually doing it or if there's a different levels of deleting Facebook where it's like, okay, I'm going to delete it from my phone, but I still have a profile and I'm just not going to use it or something. But I'm wondering, do you look at Facebook as essential at this point?
It's clear to me that Facebook wants to be essential, that this is the very business model upon which they thrive. For example, we know about free basics where Facebook wanted to essentially be internet in places like India. I think that is really scary. I think that it's possible probably to see Facebook simultaneously as an essential service in order to regulate it, but also as an essential service that could serve its own interests. Indeed, Mari Matsuda is this critical race theory founder, this founder of this notion of critical race theory. And she actually talks about the need for human rights lawyers to use this tool of multiple consciousness. I think that though this might seem a sort of unusual place to apply this sort of theory, I think that human rights lawyers and anyone actually who's a lawyer and in life in general uses these sort of multiple filters through which we see things, where we can label something the same thing, have a problem with it in one sort of conversation, but also in another moment see that it needs to be circumscribed in a certain way. So I think that this is an example of where when we want to regulate Facebook, we say, yes, it is an essential service. When we want to limit Facebook, we say, yes, it is an essential service, but it shouldn't be that essential of a service, or it should be circumscribed in that certain way. I think that tools such as Twitter, email, things that connect us as humans are essential. I think that probably the tool itself that they offer becomes essential, but that company itself, I don't want to be essential.
Right. Yeah. No, that makes sense. I think like you said, we've raised a lot of questions here. I don't think that there's necessarily a path forward, but I think the last thing I'm wondering is, people are talking about data privacy and Facebook and targeted advertising and all these issues that I think technologists and human rights lawyers and maybe some journalists have thought about for a while, but has never really come into the mainstream. Like, this story has been front page New York Times, Guardian news for going on a week now. Do you think that overall, you know, learning about this is going to be useful and productive moving forward? And how can we make sure this moment isn't lost?
I love this question. Thank you for asking it. And I just want to say as well that the work of journalists such as yourself is so important to what I think are important movements, like the privacy activist movement that we've seen essentially, particularly since Snowden's disclosures were revealed in 2014 or 13. And I think that this is a critical threshold, a new moment, sort of like the Me Too moment, where all of a sudden this spread of consciousness or this sort of knowledge seeping into our consciousness actually changes conversations on a pretty widespread and I hope deep-seated level. And I see lots of people who never even talked about privacy and their data talking about it. People even on my, like, to refer to another thing you asked, people actually talking about deleting Facebook, which surprises me because I am myself quite reliant on it. How do we not lose this moment? I think we actually can't not lose it. I think that this moment of Facebook's transfer of our data to private entities that were hired for political campaigns is such revelatory information that people, I hope, will not forget about it. And I think this, what we need to do is organize, actually. It's hard to know how to do that, but to organize and to band together and to require things of politicians and to protest would be incredible. I don't know what that looks like. I think we would need to have very specific demands, but I hope that the energy is sustained, because it seems to me that now a lot of us are privacy activists and enthusiasts, and not just with respect to privacy, but with respect to our agency, which is essentially what has been one of the things that has been undermined through the revelation that Cambridge Analytica has been used to manipulate us, even if the result hasn't been set to actually affect change on the elections, but at least to change us.
As humans, we're naturally driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. When I was looking to hire someone, it was so slow and overwhelming. I wish I had used Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform, with over 350 million global monthly visitors according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And Indeed doesn't just help you hire faster. 93% of employers agree Indeed delivers the highest quality matches compared to other job sites, according to a recent Indeed survey. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/podcast. That's Indeed.com/podcast. Terms and conditions apply.